This morning I want to say something about sermon and sermon preparation. No two people can be exactly alike in sermon preparation. I learn something from you, you from me, but we all form our own technique, own pattern, own style. Our general purposes are the same, but you have to fit it into your program and your style. The timing, all that. In a broad way to every sermon, as you know, there's both background and foreground. Don't lose the advantage of your background. If you grew up on a farm, you learn many things on the farm. Certainly you learn something about cattle, about crops, about work, about nature. Don't lose the advantage you've gained there. If you grew up in a home of labor, mechanic, blacksmith, as I did, you learn something about the laboring man. Don't lose that advantage. It'll be a part of you all your life. If you grew up in the home of a professor or a minister, there are many advantages, though sometimes your children may not think it's an advantage. But I recall Bruce Spartan, who has written many books, and one particular became quite popular in the 20s, called The Man Nobody Knows. He also wrote one on the book Nobody Knows. Bruce Spartan, a famous lawyer, leading political figure, he's, I don't know whether he's still living or not, but he belongs to a big law firm in New York. And speaking over a national radio hookup, he spoke on I think it was promoting Red Cross or something similar. He said, the thing I remember most of all about my home, his father was a minister, incidentally in Oak Park, Illinois, where I was. He said, what I remember most of all, the people that came there, visitors, missionaries, ministers, they came to our home was often crowded, we didn't have much. I remember that very few of them were well-dressed or looked like they had much. But I never saw, he said, a happier lot. More fun, more laughter, more enjoyment. He said, I've been in many homes since, but the thing I remember most of all was the happiness of the home in which I reared. He could have mentioned that his father was quite a scholar, author of numerous books, quite an authority in certain fields of labor and capital. But he didn't say anything about it. He mentioned the happiness of his home. Don't lose the advantages that you already have. Look back at your home life and see it. Now that you're an adult, you can evaluate your home much better than when you probably were 19, 20, or just began your ministry. Remember this, no one has a perfect home. There is no such thing. And when people come to me and complain about their home, father or mother, and say, this is why I am what I am, and so on. There's a certain measure of nonsense in it. We, not any of us, have a perfect home. All of us could find fault with the way we were reared, superstitions of our parents, and a lot of other things about them. But we can also, if we look, see many wonderful things that came to us through our parents. Don't lose the advantages you've gained. Then, too, you may possess certain talents. You may be very musical. You may be athletic. You may be artistic. These things can be put to advantage in the ministry. Not so that you will shine as an artist or as a musician. A friend of mine who was a fine singer, I told him to sing less because he was getting to be known as a singing preacher. Or I think of a friend of mine, Byron Nelson, who's written a number of books on evolution, as some of you have read, I'm sure, or seen. Byron graduated the seminary same time I did, and he got wrapped up in this evolution bit and wrote books on it, talked on it. So he got to be known as the evolution preacher. People didn't know which side he was on, but they knew him as the evolution preacher. And I know congregations didn't call him because they were not interested in the subject of evolution. They wanted the pastor. And all through his ministry, much as I like him, personally I've heard him, he's still in the ministry, I think. Last time I heard him was in the little church in Spooner, Wisconsin, and he was still shaking his fist at the evolutionists. Okay, if that's what you want your ministry to be, but you can get off on a tangent like that. If you have a scientific bent, fine. But don't let your talents get in the way of your ministry. Use them properly. Many a man has brought people into the church because of his talent. He's moved in musical circles, and they met him, and as a result, people have come into the church. Some people have athletic talent, and ministers, and they've drawn people into the church where they've met in athletic fields, and they can discuss athletics with them, and as a result, they draw them. Bring all your talents into captivity to the Lord. Make use of these particular advantages. Then some of you may have been reared in a small town, some of you in a big city, some in one area or other. You've got a lot under your belt and knowledge that you don't really appreciate. I wrote to a minister, I said, quit apologizing for what you know. I said, you've had a lot of experience that I've never had. Don't be afraid to say what you think and what your opinion is. People respect you. It's all right to quote, but at the same time, the people sitting in your pews want to know what you, the pastor up there, think. Is what you're preaching meaningful to you? Don't apologize for your knowledge. You've learned a lot. All of you know something I don't know. All of you have had experiences that I've never had that are valuable in the kingdom of God. Don't apologize for these things. They can be most useful, as you know. You may have gone through some bitter experiences, or you may have gone through sorrow or defeat or something. That's all can be used and put to use. I've listened to ministers to oftentimes be very apologetic. I was in Milwaukee about 10 years ago, and the minister there, Arnold Nelson, said to me, I somehow feel my sermons are no good. He said, would you come and listen to some of them? So I went over to the church, and we played off some of them on a tape recording machine. I said, those are some of the finest sermons I've heard. Those are excellent. They're orderly. You present a message. Anybody listening to those sermons could get a great deal out of them. But you preach apologetically. You preach as though you apologize for what you're saying. I think of what Edwin Booth said, the great Shakespearean actor. My minister said to him, why is it that you have crowds listen to you, and I have very few people come to listen to me? Edwin Booth said, I preach or I speak fiction as though it were the truth, and you speak the truth as though it were fiction. It's one thing it's for us to remember. Now, I'm not talking about dogmatic preaching and thundering preaching and pounding the pulpit preaching, but let us not apologize for our message. You do know something and you have had experiences. Make use of whatever talent you have. Some of you have natural wit. Make use of that. I like to believe the Lord has blessed me to a certain degree in this area. And I found it most useful in speaking to non-religious groups. And as an aside here, that's a good experience to speak to service clubs, all kinds of organizations. I've spoken to plumbers conventions, baker conventions, IWW conventions, teachers conventions, mortician conventions, and I tell you, it puts you on your mettle. They aren't listening to you or inviting you because you're a Lutheran minister. You have to deliver the goods and do it instantly. You can't say, I'll be back next Sunday. It's got to be now, and you have to capture attention. The moment you get up to speak, you have to capture attention, sustain attention, and you have many obstacles to overcome. Maybe noise, maybe half the crowd is drunk. As I spoke at the baker's convention, so many of them intoxicated that when I got up, I said, look closely. I said, there's only one man standing up here. Some of you think it's two. then I think of speaking at the Swedish club in Chicago at their 75th anniversary. It was a very elaborate affair, formal affair, everybody in formal attire except myself. And they had a long cocktail hour. They had a 7-course dinner. their chorus, Swedish chorus, you should call them, very good, gave a program of 45 minutes. Here I'm to be the speaker of the evening. Then they had the Consul General speak. They had from Consul General from Norway and several others. Believe it or not, I got on the program at exactly 12 o'clock midnight. And it was a 7:30 dinner affair. And I, first of all, I apologized for being dressed as I was, because I said no one told me it was formal attire, or I would have come dressed that way. But I said if I'd known the time I was going to get on the program, I would have worn my pajamas. And then also they had a beautiful brochure they distributed telling how their chorus had stood together for 75 years. I said, observing some of these men at the bar, I'm most amazed at how well they stood together. Well, you can use whatever wits you possess, and you can rip people lots of times when you do it, and how you do it, and do it good-naturedly. But I did say, now look here, it's late, it's 12 o'clock. Some of you are anxious to get home. I'm going to speak 10 minutes, no more than 10 minutes. If I speak beyond that, you can get up and go home. But I ask for your attention for 10 minutes. And so I spoke 9 minutes. And, of course, got a nice response from them, maybe because it was short. But you have to be ready for most anything when you speak to these groups. Anything can happen. But it puts you on your mettle. You've got to deliver the goods. And you'll fall flat on your face time and again. You'll make punk speeches. Things will go wrong. But this is part of what you go through. But it has helped me a great deal in preaching on Sunday morning. To be simple, to be direct, to get to your point, and move along. When we get up to preach on Sunday morning, that whole crowd is with us. They're on our side. We didn't need to start an argument with them. They're with us. And they'll put up with an awful lot on our part as we get up to preach. Our ponderosity and our lack of coherence, our vagueness, they'll put up with many of these things and get a great deal out of it. A sermon is quite different than a speech, of course. When your parishioners listen to you on Sunday morning, they hear every other sermon you've preached as well as the one that you're preaching. So they add in their subconscious mind all the other sermons, so that that one sermon gets tremendous value by what you say of comfort or peace or strength. It's not just the words, but all the others, and you in it. Part of your background is also in, I might say also, if you know a foreign language, it's very useful too. Enlarging your knowledge and your appreciation of people of different groups. Many of us have grown up in backgrounds. I speak Norwegian because it was a part of my childhood. I wish I knew other languages as well, could use them and speak them. It's no handicap not to be able to speak another language, but occasionally it is a distinct advantage. I remember some amusement when I was in Stockholm. I got a cinder in my eye and had to go to the hospital to have it removed. And a very fine hospital, one of the finest in the world. And the woman doctor who removed the cinder was very good doctor, very careful, and she was putting away her instruments. And I said to my guide, would you please ask her if she wants me to pay here now, or if they're going to send, if she wishes to send the bill to the hotel. So he spoke in Swedish to her, not knowing that I understood him, although I couldn't speak Swedish. You can understand it somehow. And she answered in Swedish, not knowing I understood her. And she said, we'd better collect it now or we'll never get it. He said she'd like to have you pay now, so I paid. And then I bowed low to her, and I said, "De mål vara besiktet her, Dr. Valencia. You must be careful here, doctor, what you say." And of course she threw up her hands and laughed, and we had a good joke about it. But I've had this experience many times when it comes to foreign language. Then I think of in Germany. In Berlin, I wanted to go to a drugstore, and I asked the clerk at the store, tell me how this is to be said in German, this medicine. So when I go to the drugstore, I can say it in German. So he told me the German phrase, So I went down the street, and I couldn't find any drugstore. They don't look anything like in our country. And I looked, and I couldn't. Finally, I stopped a porter in front of a hotel and said, drugstore. He couldn't understand English, and I couldn't. I mean, he rattled off in German. And he tried to guess what I wanted. Dance, dance. No, I didn't want to dance. Theater, theater. No, I didn't want to go to the theater. And I thought I'd give him an idea of medicine, so I went like this, see? He said, aha, he said, whiskey, whiskey. No, 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 no whiskey. And then finally, I got to the word apothecary. Apotheken, he got it right away then. And we, by that time, had about 15 people around us. And nobody could speak English, and it was really lots of fun. People are wonderful wherever you go in the world. They'll just about carry you down there if you let them. Then I got the idea to him, drugstore. Now, how is he going to tell where there's a drugstore? So I pointed to a big double-decker bus going down the street, and he got the idea right away. So we followed that bus going down the street, and we watched it. When it got right in front of a drugstore, he went like that. So I went there into this drugstore, and I walked up and said the medicine just the way the clerk had told me. And the clerk said to me in English, do you wish it in liquid or powder form? Yeah, pull the rug out from under me. I said, how did you know? Why, he said, the moment you walked in that door, he said, I knew that you were an American. Well, how'd you know I was an American, not an Englishman? He said, by the cut of your clothes. He said, you're well-dressed. He said, no German is dressed that good. And Englishmen aren't dressed that well. And they don't walk with the air of confidence that you Americans do. He said, when you walked in here, it was in a, he didn't say cockiness, but with an air of, you knew your way around. He said, Europeans don't do that. He said, you Americans, wherever you come into a room, or any place you come in as though you're the master of the situation. He didn't say it with any sarcasm, but that we were a confident people. Well, I said, how'd you learn your English so well? Well, we said, we all have to study it in England. We spend 6 or 7 months over there studying the English language before we're qualified to be druggists. Well, this is just an interesting aside. And English is getting more and more to be a useful language. You find it spoken wherever you go. Even in Norway they speak it.
Yeah.
So language isn't so important. Well, I also wanted to say your education is important. Certainly the college, keep up your tie with your college. When we get older, we realize college is college, and we may have shouted loyalty to our college to the nth degree when we were there, but I remember my first humbling experience when I went to study at Chicago University. I wrote down what schools, St. Olaf College. The girl says, where is that? Never heard of it. Man, alive, I thought, where's she been? I realized that a lot of people never heard of it, and never heard a lot of other schools, too. So we get over something of our provincialness by moving around, but maintain your tie to your school. All those little ties are important. They give you an anchorage. Not that you feel your school is the only thing. I always think of when I sing our college song, St. Olaf College song. I have talked on the subject of the tyranny of words, and I've sometimes used this. In our college song, High on Manitou Heights, it goes, I long to be away, day and night I long to be away at St. Olaf, the college on the hill. Well, that's sheer nonsense, I don't. I don't long to be away. I long to be away at the golf course last night, but I certainly don't long. But I'll stand up there and sing it with all my heart, with all the rest of me. Yeah. Almost the tears in my eyes. But it shows you how we use words last time, don't we? We just use these words as a sort of a sentimentalism. And I wonder sometimes if it isn't true with our hymns. The hymns that we sing. Many of our hymns, the phraseology is obsolete, but we sing them with a certain lustiness. I'll remember hearing Reinhold Niebuhr poke fun at our hymns. Could you imagine, he said to our class one day, a wealthy Episcopalian woman with diamond earrings and a diamond brooch and diamonds and a mink coat standing up and singing, "I'm a poor worm and a miserable sinner."
I take my silver and my gold.
Yeah.
Fight what I
withhold. That fits into the story of the rabbi and the cantor who thinks he's nothing. You know, there is a lot of hypocrisy in and about this way. I wish somebody would write some hymns. Most of our hymns are not of recent date. And probably we don't want them to get too close to us. Maybe we don't. We want those hymns way out there someplace. We can keep them in the emotional place. Now, also, we have come up through different traditions, different backgrounds. We might get a little bit critical of them as we get older. I'm speaking this Sunday to my congregation on having a ready answer, being ready at all times to make answer to the faith that's in you with humility and so on. We go through three mental stages, all of us, the naive, when we believe everything anybody has told us. And especially if we've got parents that have been kind and loving, a good minister, and a good teacher. We trust everybody, we love everybody, we believe everything we're told. We have a certain naivete when we approach an idea. The second stage is when we get the backstage view of life. It can be in the 20s. You sit in the audience, you know, on the stage, there you're the heroine, she looks so beautiful. And there's the hero, what a wonderful man he is. And there is the scoundrel in the play. Man, you could go up and choke him. And then you go backstage and you meet these people. Well, the heroine's all made up. She isn't quite so beautiful as she looked up there. And the hero is a stuck-up prig. He's boresome. And the scoundrel isn't such a bad cuss after all. Life is quite different when you get backstage. As I was telling some of the men this morning of the Abaramagal players, they found after World War II, the Abraham players who present the life of Christ, you know, those before the World War II, everyone was a Nazi, a pro-Nazi, except one. And that was the fellow that played the role of Judas. All the rest, Anton Lang and all the rest of them, strong men. Anton Lang, when he came to the United States, sat in a hotel lobby in New York, charging $1 for a signature his name. He just sat there, hour by hour, and they'd pile up the dollars. Can you imagine Jesus at the gate of Jerusalem sitting there signing his name, dollars? This gives us this cynical view of life. The skeptic, we become skeptical. We become skeptical about religion. The preacher isn't quite so good as he looks up there in his white robe. The teacher isn't quite so smart as he appeared before the class. My parents aren't quite so good as I thought they were as a child. You begin to get a backstage view of life. As I mentioned to you, my father gave me a book on the presidents of the United States, and they were all flawless. Everyone had no fault in them. But as I got older, I saw the cracks in all of them. Harding was a great poker player and left an illegitimate daughter. And Coolidge was a very self-centered man. When his wife bought a new cookbook, she didn't dare to tell him. She left it on the table. She paid $5-6 for it, quite a price for the book. But she didn't dare to tell him she'd bought this book. So she placed it in the parlor for him to find. Long afterwards, and he never said a word, she opened it and there he had written in it, "I find no recipe in this book for suckers." This is Calvin Coolidge. Other things went, but these are the things that, and we can learn of Lincoln, quite superstitious. We can learn of Washington, something of a ladies' man. All these men, we find cracks in them. Then, if we hang on to that skeptical period in life, we become cynics. If you hang on to the naive area and stay in that, we remain childish. We're gullible all the time. We're suckers. You've got to move. You got to retain the childlike quality from your child days. That is of curiosity, looking, gawking, wondering. I traveled in Russia with a man who was a scientist at General Motors, a General Electric. I never saw a man so curious at everything. Eddie, we go in the store, what's that? Where's that? How does this work? We went into a factory in Russia and look at the lathes, he'd examine everything. I never traveled with a man, he was twice my age at the time. But I learned an awful lot on the curiosity of the man. He'd retained his childish quality. Except you turn and becomes little children, said Jesus. How quickly we lose that quality. John Burroughs said, I never grew up, he said. I always remained a child. And Huxley said, if you want to be a true scientist, sit before the facts of life as a little child. So we must retain something of the child into the years as we go by. Then we go through the second stage of the skeptical, when the politicians are crooks. You can't trust anybody. Every virtue has its price. Look at that guy, there's a flaw in his makeup. And we love to exaggerate the flaws. We love to enlarge it. We love to give the world a feeling. We know our way around in this world. It's this worldly sophistication. Nothing kills the soul of a man so quick as to live in the area of the cynic. Nicholas Murray Butler said, on a lot of tombstones should be written, died at 30 and buried at 60. And I think this is to be said of people who get the cynical attitude. And gentlemen, don't ever assume that to be the cynic and to be intelligent are the same thing. Many a critic of the church is cynical, but it is not. And we find them within the church. Men who are cynical of the church, cynical of the officers, cynical of the departments, critical. They're all, what are they doing up there in Minneapolis and headquarters? What are they doing in St. Louis? What are they doing in New York? Franklin Fry, what is he? What Fred Shutts? I've listened to ministers pull these things apart. Don't do it. Don't ever fall into the mood of being a cynic. They have their job and it's a tough one. I don't envy any of them. The jobs that they have are pleasing 1,000 different people. And to please ministers, that's the worst lot I can think of trying to please. Because we are individualists, 100%. Watch out, don't ever get in. I'd rather be a sucker and taken in any day and be fooled than to become the sophisticated wise guys who are dead. At the age of 45, gentlemen, you go on to your greatest accomplishments or you slowly disintegrate. You have your choice. If you become a cynic, you will slowly disintegrate. If you keep your wholesome spirit, your curiosity, and if you can be a doormat, don't be afraid to be walked on. Don't be upset if people call you a big fool. I like when Lincoln was called a big fool by one of his members in the cabinet. Well, the other cabinet member said, did you hear that, Lincoln? He called you a big fool. Well, said Lincoln, he's usually right. The capacity to shrug it off and dismiss it. If anybody calls you a big fool, tell them you knew it all the time. You're surprised it took them so long to learn it. In the ministry, you have to be both a doormat and sit on the pedestal. And you have to take both with equal grace. If you can walk with kings and not lose the common touch, as Kipling said. This is what you have to be in the ministry. I once introduced Hans Lilje at the Rotary Club in Minneapolis. We had three or four other clergymen with us. And I said, before I introduce Hans Lilje, I'm going to introduce you ministers sitting there. And oh, they said, we aren't important, don't introduce us. Hans Lilje said, when you're called upon, stand up. He said, that isn't humility, he said to him, that's vanity. He said, when I was a young preacher, he said, a bishop was going to introduce me, and I said, I'm not important. And he said, he took me to task. He said, and I realized I was just pretending humility. And it's so with a lot of us too, and I've seen ministers and interviews, they just get half up to say, see how humble I am, I don't stand all the way up and show off. There's nothing worse than false humility. And we ministers are pretty clever at it. Thing is, in the third stage is the stage of wisdom, is the stage of wisdom. Common sense. This is where you move through the naive, through the skeptical, and come into the point where you can evaluate things. You can look at your childhood, you can look at people around you, you can look at values, you can see money has its place, but it's not everything. Pleasure is important, but it's not everything. Success is important, but it's not everything. Your family is important, but it's not everything. You begin to put things in their proper place, and this is wisdom. And haven't you observed that a lot of men have it without even going to school? Mm-hmm. Haven't you observed that some men that seem have the wisdom of the soil without going to college and university? I think there was Thomas Edison who wanted to hire some men for a job, and he handed one man who had not gone to school and one man who had gone through at a high degree in mathematics. He gave them an electric light bulb. Now he said, I want you to figure the volume inside the bulb. The mathematicians measured it, wrote sheaves of paper on it, and studied it very carefully. And he came out with an approximate volume of that electric light bulb with all its curves. The other man poked a hole in the end, filled it with water, then measured the water and said, here it is. There's a certain wisdom of the practical man, the man, self-made man. The self-made man has a certain wisdom that we can gain. And this is what has made much of the strength of America. We've had a lot of self-made merchants, self-made clergymen, self-made educators. A lot of self-made men who, by hard, sheer experience and toughness, have learned to get plain common sense. Growing up as I have in a poor farm, a poor family, my father blacksmith, I was the only one of six to get an education. My father had to be practical. He had to know common sense. Otherwise, he wouldn't have survived, that's all. These are important, but on the other hand, the practical self-made man is in danger of being stubborn. He has come through with his fist, and therefore he's a little bit intolerant as he goes along his way, be that as it may. All right, those are the periods through which we go. Now, in the background again of your sermon, form habits of study and reading. I mentioned to you using wisely your broken fragments of time. Our occupation as such is broken up quite a bit. We don't go to work at 9, quit at 5. It's hit or miss. I do quite a bit of reading early in the morning, quite a bit of reading in the evening, late in the evening. And I enjoy certain television programs, and I use some of them for relaxation. I can enjoy Bonanza, I can enjoy a good detective story, I can enjoy good play. I like Sunday afternoon where they interview the press, and the press interviews important people. You can learn all over, but form habits of study. The tremendous advantage of the first years of my ministry were that we didn't have so many interruptions like the minister has today. And I could set aside certain times. I graduated from college majoring in mathematics and physics. I wasn't interested in ministry until I graduated from college. But I knew nothing about history or literature or anything like that. But when I got out, I discovered I loved to read history and literature. And I read all of Shakespeare, and I started reading history, and I started reading plays of Henrik Ibsen and all the rest of them. You could do that. It's much more difficult today. The minister today, young minister, has a much harder time to block off time. And I think it was you, Bruce, mentioned that you can't be working on your sermon in the same place you're administrating the work of the church. I think that's a good thought, that if you're going to be doing some study, it can't be in the same place in which you're the administrator in the church. If you can get some room aside. Dick Raines, when he was a pastor at Hennepin United Methodist in Minneapolis, had a room in Fauchet Tower where he went to prepare his sermons. No telephone, nobody could reach him. He'd go there and shut himself out from it. Another thing is, this is an aside too. I like to have about 15 minutes of quiet before I go into the pulpit. I like to have 15 minutes where I don't see anybody, talk to anybody before I go in to preach. I like to gain my composure and get my soul in shape. But where I am, I can't do it at all. Whoever designed that church was an architect who didn't have any religion. Because he has thought nothing of getting the message over. He's thought of the architect, a glamorous church, to glorify him or the preacher. But it doesn't help, because there's no side room I can go to. There's a little room about from here to here for women preparing the communion. No place to sit down. And when four people get in there, it's crowded. I put in a folding chair once and we had to take it out, because that's the only place I can go. If I step outside, I meet the people coming to church. If I go over to my office, it's way at the other end of the building. And I'd have to walk by all the people, all the rooms to get over there. So I have no place where I can be composed. And I'm sure many times those women think I'm nuts, because I'll stand in the corner like a naughty boy and look at the wall. But you have to have it. Did you know that Paderewski, the great pianist, that before he gave a concert, he would insist on being alone in a room for half an hour? And when he walked from where he was to over to the piano, he did not want to meet anybody, talk to anybody, or see anybody. If from that room there to here he met a person, he went back into the room again for another half hour, and the concert was delayed. His aide would see to it that there was nobody between that his room and over here. And he walked up, stepped up the piano and played. He did not want anything to break this divine aura, you might say, that had gotten over him. I think sometimes we ministers just rush into the pulpit. Got our announcements, got to hurry, got to get this, watch that. And you get up there in the pulpit, and that's when you feel like relaxing, and you've got to be wide awake. it's a deadly thing, isn't it? As someone has said, a minister dreamt he was preaching and woke up and found that he was. This can easily happen because of your rush. In my parishes, in all of the parishes except this one where I am, and I don't know how to remedy it, I've tried many different things, but nothing succeeds. In all my other parishes, I had a room aside. About 5-10 minutes before the sermon, the deacons would come in. I'd offer a prayer with them. We'd just say good morning, and then they'd walk out, and nobody else would come in. I did the same thing in Minneapolis Central Lutheran Church. Maybe just one deacon, two deacons, but always one would come in there just for a moment of prayer and quiet. I didn't want to see anybody. When I went into the chancel, I had a chance to get my emotions in balance again. To me, this is very, very necessary. Jesus found it necessary, and we should too. Now, I said form the habits of study, give some direction to your study, if you can. Some of you are by nature students, good students, and scholars. There's a difference, as you know. I like to think I'm a student, but I know I'm not a scholar. That's quite a different thing. The scholar has the capacity to go into a subject. He knows his Hebrew, his Greek, his Latin. And you and I, as ordinary preachers, are very dependable on those men, dependent on those men. The theologian and the scholar, I don't know where we'd be without them. As I've said to the seminary professors, we lean on you men heavily. Not only you here, but all scholars down through the years. Think of the research they've done in the Bible. Think of the massive knowledge that they provided for us. So let us not poke fun at theologians. Let us not ridicule the scholar. These men are indispensable to us. But cultivate an inquiring mind. Whoever you're visiting with, or talking, the plumber, the ditch digger, the garbage collector, the waitress. As I've traveled about the world, I usually talk to the waitress, the stewardess, the pilot, and I just thought, I'm a Lutheran minister, I'm American, I'm curious. And most people are so wonderful, they'll do anything for you. If you come down from your pedestal up here and just be an ordinary mortal. This is a rather lengthy introduction. Now, when you come into the church on Sunday morning, we haven't yet come to the sermon. The setting is very important. Many a sermon can be spoiled by the setting. When I go to preach to a place like I am a couple of weeks in Minneapolis, I will try to get there a day before, go into the church, walk around it, see from where I preach, I'm short of stature. Pastor Youngdahl, tall of stature. I might come into a pulpit that reaches about my chin, and I can defeat much of what I'm going to say because of that very fact. In my own pulpit where I am, it is one of these architect designs, you know. They aren't interested in what comes from the pulpit. They just want a beautiful. So I got a big marble pulpit, a wall, as it were, created between the odd congregation. Worst kind of pulpit you can have. Don't ever put it in stone. Wood is much warmer. Right? My way, I do away with the pulpit. And I put in a little stand there, made a little stand in my pulpit that raises me up about 2-3 inches. Just to get, I like to have the feel that the pulpit hits me here. Small thing, but it's important. Then when you come to speak at a place, if I were to come to your place, I'd want to see, is there bright light any place in back of me? So that when people are looking at me, they don't have a bright light. Well, the first thing I did when I came here is pull the shade. I didn't want a bright light in back of me, because it can be disturbing. In the church I'm in now, the whole back is a stained glass window. After you've sat there for a few minutes, people come and say, isn't this magnificent? But you sit there for 15 minutes. And pretty soon you're doing like this. There's bright yellow and reds and blues get under you. And here I stand speaking with that as the background. I painted out a large share of the window right in back of the pulpit. Just so that at least where the pulpit stands, the light doesn't come through as that power. I have people even come to church there with colored glasses on, members, because they couldn't stand the brightness of the light. Think of the stupidity of architects. But you can't wholly blame them either. They collect their money. Then I think in terms of your pulpit, its location, the light that's in back of you, temperature is important. I check the temperature. Is it too warm? Is it too chilly? If you've got an older congregation, they want the temperature up. I had an older congregation in Chicago. They always want it warm. I have a young congregation now, although they want it cool. It's different. I had the janitor in Eau Claire, who was great on wanting the temperature up. And he'd say to me, it's 70 degrees. That's what the thermometer says. And I couldn't win any argument. I said, but Johnson, I said, the congregation brings up the temperature. Doesn't make any difference. The book says 70 degrees. Well, we settled it very nicely. One day I went in there and I raised the glass of the thermometer 3 degrees. So that when it registered 70, it was only 67. He was satisfied, I was satisfied. He went by the glass and I went by the temperature. Light is another thing. When I came to Oak Park, Illinois, they had beautiful stained glass light pictures, but produced no light, just as dim as could be. I accused them of having tavern lighting. I said, most of you fellows hang around the tavern. I said, trustees, that's why you like this lighting. It took almost 5 years before I could get them to change the lighting, and we finally got it changed. It took all the while I was there to improve many of the things that were in the church to make it more worshipable. They had a little dinky cross on the altar that about that big. I got that changed to a marble cross about that big. And then when I, just before I left, we had a program in which people gave money to it. We changed the whole chancel, and now it has a magnificent cross. The moment you come in there, it gives depth and feeling and quality, in my opinion, to the church, without stealing from the pulpit and the altar. So as you come into a church, walk around, sit in the pew, and imagine what you would want as you sit in the pew. There are other things too, light, heat, length of service. And I think our liturgy fights us rather than helps us. I think our Sunday morning liturgy doesn't prepare the people for the sermon. I think it's too ponderous, as I said. It doesn't begin with joy, it doesn't begin with gladness. We sock them right on the head to begin with a confession of sin. I'm poor, sinful person, sinned against thee by thought, word, and deed. I flee for refuge. Who flees for refuge? And they sit comfortable half awake. I think what we ought to do is start out with something triumphant, something victorious, something glorious. And then we can move into it. And I don't think the confession of sin should be every Sunday. And I think how simple is the confession taught to us, Jesus. God, be merciful to me, a sinner. Boy, does that strike. And then I would have short sentences of meditation, like saying, I've sinned against my wife this week because I lost my temper. Boy, that would be terrible. And I've sinned against my children because I didn't give them enough time. If we made a number of little suggestions for them to pray silently, I think then we'd make something out of this confession. Now it's just like my sin, about sin all day and night alone to be away. It just becomes about as meaningless. Why in thunder, ministers, can't we be honest and see things as they really are? I think our service doesn't prepare them for the sermon. This church I mentioned in Gardena in South Los Angeles, where they have 2,000 people. The moment you come in there, you get a feeling it's wonderful to be a Christian. Joy. But he isn't afraid to put the thumb on evil, too. But he does it with Christian love. He speaks the truth in love. But you come in with a feeling of joy, and you go out feeling, I want to go out in the world and to do something for the cause of Christ. This is something I have a feeling in the liturgy doesn't give. It's too much of the Middle Ages. Like some of our paintings.
Jordy?
Yeah?
I noticed in some of the other churches that start out with the singing of the doxology and so forth, this was really quite a moving experience during the summertime when you go across the country go to a different church, not necessarily Lutheran.
How did you react to it?
I appreciate it. I think it was to begin with, it was kind of a shock because we're not used to it.
No.
But when you think back on it, it really was a wonderful expression of thankfulness to God.
I think it was Fosdick's church when he was a pastor in New York, Riverside, had the same experience. They started out with a triumphant message, short from the choir. And then he said, the Lord is in his holy temple, Fosdick said from the side, coming and echoing through the room. And you felt something tremendous is taking place. You hear that feeling.
In a new communication, you remember, a month or two ago, from our department of church music, they had a number of suggestions, well, really, adding up to change things,
yes.
Eliminate, substitute.
Yes.
And one of them was this, on the festivals and on other occasions, eliminate the confessional and begin exactly with this way.
The intro, doesn't it?
Yeah, begin that way.
I think it's okay.
And because this is... Or as you imply,
or him, yeah. Another great thing he suggested there was the Apostles' Creed after the sermon.
Yeah.
I think that's great. And I'm going to next fall start that. I have asked permission from my council to make changes in the liturgy, and they voted for permission. And that's one thing. Think of after your sermon, if the congregation stood up and says, I believe, instead of some soothing hymn.
Shorty, there was this pastor that every single Sunday without fail begins the service with the resurrection hymn. Doesn't matter what season.
Is that so?
Whether it's Christmas or Lent or Advent, whatever. Always triumphant. The whole congregation rises. They fantastic processionals.
Isn't that something?
Always with an Easter hymn. And there's something worth
Yes, it is. Something in it. Yes. You see, we're doing it every Sunday, and after Sunday may think it's commonplace, but we forget that the people in the pew may be different from Sunday to Sunday, and also that they haven't been through the week what we've been through.
That's right.
Don't be afraid of repetition. Well,
standing at the beginning of the service, I'd just be interested how many of the fellows have their congregation stand. Or I was thinking the other day, this has occurred to me many times, right before the last verse, so often the last verse of an opening hymn of praise is really solid, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And what how tremendous it would be when just before you come to the last verse, I suppose it'd be a certain amount of commotion, but but the organ could play, and then everybody would stand as we sing the last verse of the opening hymn. Then they'd be standing as you, you know, when you begin the service. I just wondered how many here stand.
We stand for the opening hymn anyway.
We do too.
The first thing we do.
Mm-hmm. We stand for the last verse is all.
Just the last verse. How have you found that?
No problem.
Uh-huh.
It has one advantage as far as late comers, of course, that it's easier to seat them.
Uh-huh. Good.
Any other comment about that? That's coffee, is that what that means?
Yeah.
Okay. We'll get after the sermon next time. Finally get there.
I'm wondering whether you would say a little bit before you leave us on the subject of the pastor grief, the personal grief experience, where you've lost a son and I knew him quite well. I've often thought of you in this connection, how this affected you personally in the ministry.
Well, it's a tender
either
spot.
Either now or at noon,
yes,
before we leave.
Yes, I'd be glad to.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I'd be glad to. When we had coffee.
Okay.
Maybe we'll never get to the sermon.
Suspicious.
I can remember my five-year-old praying specifically about this, you know, noises in the night. And
they're very real.
And there's no the whole world is moving.
Around every corner.
Men from all over the country, and I think it had its beginning as his interest in these good things. He since passed away, died of a heart attack. But don't underestimate the value of these little letters to people, businessmen, merchants, and so on, even politicians, governor. When Senator Humphrey was defeated in his attempt to be president back there some years ago, I wrote him a letter and I said, now lay aside all ambitions and become the best senator you know how. And I said, you can make a valuable contribution to the United States by being the best senator there is in the Senate. He wrote me a beautiful letter back. And whenever articles appear in magazines by him, I write him a letter congratulating him and thanking him. He immediately get a letter back. And I've gotten a letter from him since now, since he's running for president. I don't care who the man is. You yourself know of some even obscure member of your church sends you a letter. Appreciation. You like it. Well, this is getting a little off the track, but it's important too. I mentioned the church building conducive to worship. This is something I've done for many years. Before services start, and I particularly did it in Minneapolis and Milwaukee, I have a little more difficulty where I am in this present church. But I would go into the church at least a half hour before church services. Nobody in there. And my janitor in Minneapolis, Milwaukee, had instructions not to let anybody in the church when I was in there. I'd walk around in the church and I'd sit in different places in the pews. And I'd imagine I was somebody. Some of these members of my church. I'm Mrs. Jones today. I'm Mary so-and-so today. I'm this fellow, 45, who's lost a job. And I look up at the pulpit and I'd say, Yortland, what do you got to say to me? That'll be helpful. And it helps your imagination so that you get out of the pulpit into the pew. And I found out just to sit in there in that pew and look up at the pulpit and know that within a half hour, hour, I'll be standing up in that pulpit preaching, talking to the men down there. It gets you out of that pulpit down into the pew. Try it. You men who have been laymen and out of the pulpit, as you have, Olaf, you have gotten something in that field and know what it is to sit in the pew and look up at the pulpit. But if you can do it with your own people, imagine somebody's had grief, somebody's had trouble, somebody's a young couple lost a baby, and here they dreamed about this home being established. Imagine you're that person. This is when one of the most helpful things to make my sermon realistic, down to earth. Anyone, any contribution on that score, in your experience that you've done? The nicest compliment I ever received from anybody was when I preached at a church in northern Wisconsin, many farmers in there, The farmer came up to me afterwards and he said, "Pastor, you came down out of the pulpit and sat in the pew with us today." And I appreciate that very much. Another compliment that I always like is when a 12 or 13 year old boy or girl says, "I understood everything in your sermon." If I can get them, I know I can get the older ones too. If I can get their sustained attention, interest of a 12, 13 year old boy or girl, it does mean something. Well, sit in the pew and imagine you're among the unemployed, the sorrowful. And then when you walk around the church, is it orderly? Anything stuck on the piano? Is the piano open? Are books laying around? Are the lights working? Is the microphone connected? I still check all the microphones before my service starts. Go and tap each one of them. Again and again I found if I fail to do it, I catch one that isn't quite connected, or plugged in at the wrong place, or turned up too loud. Small things. But if you worked around in my office with me, you'd hear over and over again a quotation from Dickens. Dickens said, "Genius is respect for details." And it's a very good definition. Genius is respect for details. Watch the little details. Then I mentioned temperature and so on, light, eye strain. I instruct my head usher to get in touch with me just before services. So if there's any area to be blocked off, any difficulties, any problems, he'll come to me and say, "Anything, Pastor? Any instructions?" Maybe there's a colored person I've seen come in and sit down early. I'll say, "See to that a woman sits next to him who will be congenial," and show her the hymn book or where the service is. One of the problems, of course, in some churches, we always had this somewhat in Central Lutheran Church, you'd have fanatic screwballs. I had a woman try to come up out of the office and sit in the chancel with me. I've had one man get up and scream during the service. I had a person die during the service. I've had people have epileptic seizures during the service. Wailing babies. Man, I'd like to give a lecture to mothers who think their children are cute if they tear up the hymn book or mark. I got a pew in my church right now that is carving in it from some little child playing with something sharp during the service. A wailing baby can be very disturbing. To me, it is. No orchestra or concert will permit a crying baby. They stop. And no person could bring in a crying baby. I like to see children in church, but we have a nursery for babies that cry. I tell the ushers, if somebody comes in the baby, first recommend the nursery. If they want to go in, then seat them in the rear. And I've told my ushers, if they're disturbing, go right down where I don't care if I'm preaching, go and say, "Would you please take the child to the nursery?" And in the church at Central, my ushers are drilled on this score. Boy, a baby wouldn't cry without an usher being right there. And so it got to be known in the church. And as a result, that disturbance is eliminated. Now, there are different parishes. I spoke in the church in Mount Horb, rural church, where there were babies and everything else. I didn't bother that preacher, and it did me. I couldn't listen and concentrate on the sermon while all these babies were wailing. And you'd be interested to know, in Java, in Medan, we have a large Lutheran center up there among the Bataks. And I have a picture of a church, and right alongside it is a doll's house church. It's fairly good size, but mothers with babies go over here and sit for the service. And the minister comes from the main church at one point and comes over and gives a little short sermon, and somebody else takes part and conducts all the rest of the liturgy. But even they don't want the little babies in the church service, so to disturb it and problem. Now, maybe you don't have a problem. What do you men do about it? Is that any problem?
I think it's a constant problem in our congregation because our congregation is so young. I have stopped in the middle of a sermon and have asked the person to leave. a little bit hard to do, but that one was going from the very beginning of the service, and I just got into the pulpit, and I wasn't about to listen for another 20 minutes. So I just stopped, and I asked, we do have a nursery. Would you mind taking the nursery or something like that? She got up, and she left. And she's come back since that time. But she really wasn't aware, I don't think, of how much disturbance it was causing.
Yeah.
Our ushers are asked to talk to people if they get it up.
And we know how sensitive mothers and parents can be. Doesn't matter how much their kids wail, they think, and people turn and look, and they think they're looking at the sweet little child.
I think they're so used to it that they aren't even aware. This is a constant jingle jangle that they live with, and they aren't even aware of it all the time.
I think of the minister who stopped and said, I know that baby's thinking the same as I am, that she wishes she was some other place. Yes?
I had an experience in my last parish, which might be helpful. One of the members of the Board of Education, she was my chief arch enemy in that place. She finally left. She was a Baptist. She didn't belong to Lutheran Church in the first place. She ran the congregation, and she boasted when I came there that this was a family church, and she wanted to be sure to impress that upon me, that they brought the babies and the children, and they all came. This was different. This was really the work of the Holy Spirit. Well, the work of the Holy Spirit, I found out, was a bunch of mothers sitting back there with screaming babies, and they just yell and hoot, and it was just impossible. I don't care. Jesus Christ had been there, he could have reached those people. And we did have a cry room with glass windows, but they refused to sit in there because they were supposed to bring their children to church. This is where they started, when they were babes in arms. So I brought this up with the church council, and they agreed. They said, this has to be stopped. And this has been going on for months. Nobody appreciated it. In fact, it's been emptying out the church. It doesn't make sense. And with students coming from the university, this is the most annoying thing in the world. So we started with a bulletin and asked them kindly if they would bring their babies cry, their children cry. This is very natural that they bring them back into the cry room. And the ushers would show them that they were strangers where the cry room was. Well, I got some feedback on that, of course. And that this pastor didn't want little children like the Lord did. And there were three or four of them that refused to bring the children back there, and they moved farther front in the church instead of staying back. So finally the church council and the ushers got together, and they took some very stern measures, and I let them do it so I could say they were the ones that decided this. But they finally would tell them then that the cry room was back there. Would you please bring the children back there? And it took a year's time, almost a year's time, before we got a quiet church where unruffled nerves could come and sit down and receive some serenity. But this was really. And this was the pitch that was used, you see. It's sort of vicious, because how can you, you can't argue against little children and the Lord blessing little children. This is one thing, we try to tell them that, but this whole idea here of bringing the baby and the child, and they remembered, and believe me, their mothers, they brought them to church, and they sat through church for an hour and a half and 2 hours, and they were babes in arms, and was perfectly all right then. Why isn't it all right now, you see?
Can I just throw in a question here? I just appreciate your reaction, or anybody's, as to when should children begin to come to church? We end up with about 50% by confirmation, and I'm afraid not having been in church. And I'm just struggling with the question is, when, obviously, that isn't what we want. I just wonder, in tradition, in history, or in the capacity of a child, when?
I don't mind even if they're 4 or 5 years of age. I think I like what Albert Schweitzer said. When I went to church, he said, I didn't understand what was going on. Mm-hmm. He said, I was really young, but I knew something important was taking place.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was important to the parents. And I knew this important part, if it was important to them, eventually I wanted to know what this important was. So I think if you get little or nothing, I think of the wife of Reverend Thompson at Central Lutheran Church, Orrin Thompson. His wife is Doris Cron. I confirmed her in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Doris, when she was a little girl, used to come to church and sit with the parents every Sunday. She was only 6, 7 years of age. And I met her on the street one day when she was a little girl, and I tease her about this now. I said, Doris, it's certainly nice to see you in church every Sunday. Oh, she said, I like to go to church. She says, I like the music, but I don't care about the sermon. So now she's a grown woman and a wife of the minister, so I tease her about that. But the children, some children with their parents are taught right away to behave and pay attention, reverence. I like to see them. I don't care how small they are. But that wailing baby is another thing.
I used to have a congregation where it was a very small one, about 200 souls. And a good percentage of them were very strict, of kind of Dutch ancestry, that had come into the Lutheran church in this little town. The only time we could have service in the winter was afternoon. The rest of the time was in the evening, 8 o'clock too, after all chores, after everything else, and so on. And one farmer, a man about 30, had one son who was about 3, 4 years old, only child. And for a while, the son would be fussing in the evening. You can't blame him, you know. They had to bring everybody there. They didn't know about babysitters, you know. Well, anyway, this kid was kind of fussing, and he was loud one time, right in the middle of the sermon. It was all quiet, you know, except for this one child. The others were quiet, or they gave him stuff to do or eat or something. And he went out, and there was just a little sort of narthex around there. And little narthex, all of a sudden there was a sound. And then he walked to this big tall father about 6'4", and a little tiny boy about 4 or 5 years old, little tiny boy. Back they walked, holding his hand, sat down the same place, 3/4 of the way up, sat down. That child never from then on had any keep in church.
He's normally from Dutch background. I can remember my father doing that to me.
Is that so?
Yes, sir.
Well, me Norwegian, because you have
the words. We, in the bulletin, ask all families with younger children to be seated on one side. And then a family that, or an older couple that would be more distracted or not used to this, they're on the other side.
That's a great idea. Mm-hmm.
You're not nearly as distracted by noise on the side of you as you are in front or behind you.
Yeah.
And the parents with children are more...
They don't.
They aren't irritated, and they're all in the same boat on that one side.
That's a good thought.
But to these that ask, or say, let the children come unto me, or with wailing children, I say, okay, let the child walk up to the front, and we'll keep them in church. Because Jesus did say, suffer them to come unto me.
It's a suffering, forbid them.
And forbid them not. And they must have been old enough to be able to walk stand in front of him.
That's a good point.
And I don't think he was necessarily referring to screaming babies.
No.
In Luke, though, the Greek word is technia, which is baby child.
Yeah.
Can we get to the sermon?
Yeah, let's go back.
Okay.
Sure.
I mentioned the liturgy. Liturgy can be very meaningful. Be careful how you conduct it. Do not conduct the liturgy as though you're hollering down a barrel. This thunderous way of saying, in the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, some similar phrase. Give it reality as much as you can. Clear, distinct, don't race through it. Liturgy is important. Don't misinterpret what I've said previous to this. It is very important. And a lot of people get a great deal out of liturgy, much more than sometimes we may think who are less liturgically minded. I had a man in Eau Claire that used to come just for the sermon, sit up in the belfry, fold his arms, and look at me all during the sermon, then he'd stalk out right after the sermon.
I met him on the street, and his name was Sather, and I said, why do you do that? Well, he said, the sermon's the only thing that's important to me. He said, the rest isn't. He said, all the rest is just filling. Just to kill time, he said, to forget the sermon. Well, I said, now supposing everybody felt like you. Supposing those people who just liked the liturgy came for that and then left when the sermon began. Supposing only those that liked the anthem stayed for that. I said, who would be there when we took the collection? but he got the idea. I said, you have to sit through some things that you don't like as others have to sit through some things you like. So after that, he did become a very attentive member.
And it isn't only children that are supposed to suffer.
Yeah. now, let me see here. Where did I leave off here? In preaching, I have certain objectives in mind, just the same as when I teach confirmation class. When I have a confirmation class, I'm not thinking of them in the class, but when they're confirmed, I have the objective to see that they will go to church and have a private devotional life. Second is that they will support, be active in the church as it were itself. In this first part, it's read the Bible, prayer, go to church. And the second one is to work in the church, support it. And the third is that there will be responsible Christians in the community. These are the objectives I have underneath the surface all the time when I'm teaching confirmation class. And I aim in that direction, not whether they can memorize the Ten Commandments or this or that. All these things must fit in. Now, when it comes to the sermon, I have certain basic, hidden, as it were, motivations I want to create. One is the feeling of security. There are three basic needs in life. Everybody must have a feeling of security. Underneath are the everlasting arms. The Lord is the light of my life. I shall be with thee always. This is the feeling of security. Everybody must have it. I don't care who it is. A little child must have the feeling of security. I think of a refugee child following the nurse around in the ward, going from place to place, and the nurse said to the little boy, what is it you want? He said, I want to be near somebody who cares about me. That feeling of security. And this is very important. We can get false security, you see, money, things, the preacher, the building, but it must be God. And I try to bring in there, in the sermon, always someplace, which is the greatest help for anybody who is in grief or sorrow. They feel there's something steady that's unshakable, dependable. I preached last Sunday on a sermon, the theme I'm going to use in Minneapolis too. It is this, you can't pull down the stars. A French peasant during the French Revolution met a revolutionary. And when the peasant said he was on his way to the church, the revolutionary said to him, we'll pull down your churches and we'll destroy religion. And the peasant said, you can destroy our churches, but you can't pull down the stars. There are some things you cannot pull down. The feeling of security. In this, you see, comes the feeling of that we are forgiven, not by our neighbor, but God forgives us. He gives us a feeling of security. And since you mentioned me and my son, I can bring this in here, I hope. Every home has its grief and sorrow. Mine isn't the only one. And you men will have yours, too. Death of a friend, a child, a mate. If you go to Kalispell, Montana, you'll find the youth building there has on it, in memory of Bud Yorton, that was my son. And he was a minister there one summer, his internship in his last year at the seminary. He was not intern, but he was just, we were without a pastor. And he won their affection so much that when they built this youth building, they built it in his memory. There are many things I could say, but about his ministry and our attachment to one another. But when I was visiting with the pastor who's there now, I didn't know him, but he stopped in to see me just recently out in California, and telling me about this building. He said he'd like to meet me. And I said, I'm sure you've had your grief too. He said, yes. I had a 9-year-old boy that was not long ago accidentally killed. And I said, well, to me that is even worse. My son died of bulbar polio, over which so nobody could do anything. But here is the carelessness of somebody with a gun. A man leaves his gun for it, and his child takes it and bing, kills his minister's son. Grief is everywhere. It's not an uncommon thing. But of course, as somebody said, it really never happens until it happens to you. You can read the obituary column. You can read about accidents. You can read about deaths. But it's quite something else when it strikes you. My son and I were very close together. We were almost inseparable. We went into the war together. We separated in Chicago. He was only 17. We didn't see each other for 3.5 years. He went through much more than I did in the South Pacific. Out of 200 in his group, only 25 came back alive. He was a machine gunner. And he went through quite a bit. When he came back, he went through St. Olaf and the seminary. But when we shook hands with each other in Chicago and said goodbye to each other, he said, Dad, for you, I'll do my best. I never forgot. I better change the subject. The second thing in the sermon must be movement. It must progress. It can't stop at a given point. Fits here too. But if I may recapture myself again. After my son's death, I thought I had to be a good Christian and conceal the grief. As a Christian, I should not show. I should believe and have faith and shouldn't have any grief. And so I concealed it. But then I became quite ill a year later and had to go to the hospital. And when I had this operation, gallstones removed, I had a peculiar reaction. I was crying all the time. And I couldn't get over it, couldn't stop it. And a very sensible doctor sat with me, and he said, you bottled up your emotions, and you wouldn't let them go. He said, and now, under the influence of the drugs, it comes to the surface, and you cannot any longer control it. So that taught me a lesson, that we have to let people let go of their grief some way or other. And it's not Christian, in my opinion, to crush it. There are many different ways, of course, in which grief can come out. It comes out oftentimes in self-pity, and we carry it on our sleeves. So we invite people to feel sorry for us. This is deadly and can destroy you. The other is to become calloused and tough. That's bad too. I think all things work together for good to them that love the Lord. The thing is, you just keep going. That's the important thing. When Jesus died upon the cross, you'll notice the women went about getting the spices and doing the work. They kept going. The disciples stayed by themselves. They made the mistake. The women just kept going. And you have to go through the motions many times of living, even when you don't feel like it. And going through the motions eventually, then you are capable of handling the grief that comes to you. I think this is an important lesson. I was amazed at how callous some people can be too in these things. A week after my son died, there had been a man who wanted to sell me something for my house. He'd been there to see me a couple times, pertaining to the furnace. He called me up a week later. Say, he said, I read the paper, you lost a kid in your family. He said, I can't remember whether it was boy or girl. What was it, he said. Imagine a man calling me like that a week later. It's just like putting a knife and say, you lost a cat or a dog or something like that. it reminds you again, nothing really happens until it happens to you.
Dr. Yortland, I appreciate what you said there on the matter of your year later and the delayed grief, because I had the same experience. You were in Minneapolis, and then I came over for the funeral from Milwaukee. And it was kind of interesting being around the Milwaukee congregation, too, share. I almost, Hoover was kind of happy that I wanted to go over to the funeral, you know, seeing it was really a classmate of mine. Mm-hmm. And that this could kind of share back to your former parish in a way. And I think I was instrumental in helping a little bit there too with them. But this business of the picture I have of you, mm-hmm. I was there this Sunday. Wasn't on a Monday the funeral?
Yes, the funeral was on a Monday.
Right, and on a Sunday you preached. That's at, right. I was there at the 9 o'clock service, and realized, and amazed at your proclaiming the Word of God even at that time. And then, of course, of the funeral, your countenance and the brightness, the victory. I think this did an awful lot for me, mm-hmm. In the matter of your display, not admiring you as much as realizing what the resurrection means to us as Christians, mm-hmm. and that funeral of almost being a uncanny sort of lifting, which many of us would like to see funerals be. You know, almost a model situation of the two choirs and the word proclaimed and your witness of the radiance of being in Christ and what resurrection meant and that going on. But I'm also very happy sitting here knowing you're a human being. You see what I mean?
Yes.
That that the emotion and the grief caught up with you, and I suppose now one could look back and say it would be a terrible and awful price to pay just to witness in that frame of mind. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure that's what it was supposed to be, but you know, in that sense.
Yes.
But for most of us human beings, I suppose you wouldn't recommend that now.
Well, yes, I recommend it in the sense that the thing is to keep going. At the moment, you can't handle your emotions. If I'd allowed the grief to take hold of me at the time, I wouldn't have been able to carry on as a minister. It would eventually sock me down. But by preparing the sermon, getting up the preaching, doing your work, whether you wanted to or not, you come through victorious, but I carried it too far. I carried it too far. And my emotions wanted to come, but in the strange way it came out too. I spoke frequently in places, and if I kept being funny, I was funnier than ever.
Sure.
My tongue was wittier, and I saw things humorous, and I'd often have audiences in stitches laughing. Mm-hmm. And then I'd go home and feel miserable. It's a strange thing, isn't it? I suppose it depends a lot on one's closeness to one's own child, you see. He was married at the time and lived in Minneapolis, of course. He used to call me every day or come over to see me every day. And it was. And when he got ill, he called up and said, "Dad, there's something wrong with my stomach. I can't. My stomach doesn't function." Now I suggested some things, and I said, "I'll be right over." And so I gave him some medicine the next morning, 4 o'clock, his wife said that he's still complaining. So I called the doctor, and at the time we went right over there, and the doctor said, "Put your chin down," and he couldn't do it. And that's the sign of polio. And immediately called an ambulance. And we went to the hospital, and he's gone in 3 days. But the interesting thing too, I went around in Sister Kenny Institute. As you know, that whole place, it used to be 4 people suffering from polio. Amazing the number of people in these conditions. At the same time, my son was in the hospital. My granddaughter was in too with polio. Most people didn't know that. She was there too, 4 years of age. And when she got to be about 14, 15 years of age, the doctor said, you'll not be able to bear children. You don't have the muscular strength here. So they operated on her and removed the muscle from her thighs and sewed them in here. So she's just as good as can be right now. Amazing, isn't it? Kenny Institute no longer exists as a place for polio because of sock vaccine. I had many unusual experiences then. I remember at the time he was sick, Mona said, shouldn't we pray for his recovery? I said, I wonder, Mona, if we have a right to. I wonder if we have a right to. Bulbar polio kills. It's a deadly disease. It's under control. I said, what right have we to expect God to change the laws of the universe for our particular benefit? All we can pray is that if there's something we're not doing to recover, to tell us. And second is that something may be learned out of this that may be of help for others. That's, I said, all we can pray for. It is a tough thing for a young wife to go through, too. Mm. All right, the sermon must move much better than my lectures have. It must march. You must have a sense of movement to it. Jesus said, I must be on my way today, tomorrow, and the day thereafter. It moves, it marches. I press on to the high calling of God, said Paul. A sense of movement. And life is that way. You're born, you're a baby, you're a child, you're a youth. There's maturity, there's age, there's sod, then God. You're a freshman, you're a sophomore, you graduate, you're shingle, so on. Life moves on, and the sermon must have a sense of movement to it. Third thing a sermon should have in it is a feeling, sense of mystery. You haven't got all the answers. And isn't it amazing how many times the word behold appears in the Bible? Behold, 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 a sense of mystery. And there should be the quality in it also of ethics. What's the right thing to do in life? And the race problem. I had an interesting experience in Milwaukee. As a woman, I preached a sermon one Sunday on the subject, what's the right thing to do? And there was a lady in the service who was in the Boston store the next day and got changed for a $10 bill when she'd only given $5. She told me about it afterwards that she felt pretty tickled. $5 ahead, pretty smart. But as she was pushing the door open, the sermon came. What's the right thing to do? What's the right thing to do? Thundered, she said in her head, and she returned and gave back the $5 that didn't belong to her. That's the ethic content. Whether it's in race relationship or anything else, our preaching should be such that the man gets into business or active life, it should affect him. When I was in Minneapolis, I was talking on somewhat this subject, and a man in one of the neighboring towns was in church. He sold farm machinery. He was a big dealer in farm machinery. And during the war, of course, World War II, it was almost impossible to get farm machinery. But at the end of the war, and after about 6 months, he got a half a train load of farm machinery costing thousands of dollars. Before he could unload it, two men came from Chicago and said, turn the bill of lading over to us, and we will pay you exactly what it's worth and also the profit you'd get from the farmers. He said, nothing doing. They added $10,000. They said, we'll add $10,000 to it. He said, nothing doing. And he said they brought it up to $20,000. He said, in jest, they were getting close to my price. But he really didn't mean it. But he did say to me, I wondered afterwards why I refused them. Why did I refuse? He said, I like money and I can use it. Was it love of my family? No, he said, I love them, but I don't think that was it. Was it the farmers? No, he said, most of them think I was a fool, didn't make that good money. He said, something inside me said this would be wrong. Something inside me said it would be wrong. The ethics in your preaching. Then, now we come to the minister in the chancel. I'll quickly go over that. Watch out so your movements in the chancel aren't bouncing around. flitting from place to place, going in and out of the chancel, singing lustily one line, then silent the rest of it. letting the congregation know what a magnificent voice you have. And then after you've done that, you quit the hymn. Watch out for being personally conspicuous in the chancel. Move with a certain dignity, and that you're a master of the situation. See that your robe is neat, clean, hangs straight, that you don't have light socks, light shoes, and your suit is one of dignity. I'm thinking now after the service, if you move around before and after the service. I have a young assistant pastor whom I'm having quite a job with. He's of the new school. He raised a beard, and not that I'm particularly against a beard, I told him, but he offended some people, and I said, if you give offense, I think it should be changed. What's that got to do with the gospel? Well, it has quite a bit to do with it, I told him. You block the mind of some people. One lady said, I just don't like to take communion from you when I look up at you and see that bearded face. The members began to call him Moses. Then besides that, he'll come around, then I come around without a coat. These things, you know, every young minister goes through, I suppose. He'd come around without a coat, tie, but not nearly as bad as one I had in Chicago. Assistant pastor come around in shorts and no top, and sit at his desk. And sometimes just and meet people like that. Or smoking a long pipe or a long cigar, and then come on a bicycle and a little cap. And then when I admonish him, of course, I am an old fogey. I think the Lord is a special blessing for us senior pastors. Because of sometimes what we have to put through. But usually they come through. It takes a little time and patience. And I suppose I was just as stupid when I began my ministry as they are. I think a minister should have a certain dignity about his clothes and appearance. You're going playing golf, you wear golf clothes. But around the church, I'm dressed up all the time around the church. I can take off my coat, but there's dignity to the dress. I'm not coming around in shorts. I got shorts, too. I got these, whatever you call them, Bermudas. I had a picture taken of me once over in India. You ought to see it. My wife never advised me again to wear them. Such a bony structure you never saw. Then when you make your announcements, see that they're brief, to the point. You may have your announcements end or beginning. I like them where I put them myself because it gives a break in that ponderous liturgy. So I can throw a pinch of humor and let them relax a little bit, and I notice how they like it. But I've known ministers that spend 10, 15, 20 minutes in their announcements. Be careful about it. You may have a problem of visitors. We have quite a few visitors. We tried different stunts, if you can call them stunts. One is we give them a little red ribbon to wear. And so anybody looking around knows it's a visitor, but most of them don't like that red ribbon to wear. We had a little nice little flower, paper flower. They preferred that, but they're too expensive. And now I have the visitors to stand, any visitors on Sunday morning to stand. And I ask the members of the congregation to please note where the visitors are and make it a point to shake their hand and welcome them into the church. There are many different ways, and you may have a better one. Now coming to the sermon, finally, ultimately. We have the text assigned for us. First 10 years of my ministry, I followed the pericopes very carefully and wrote my sermons out first 10 years very carefully. And I think it's a good discipline. I think it did me a lot of good. As time went on, I began to deviate from the assigned text. But I still take about 50 to 75% of the text on Sunday. But many times the text doesn't click with me, and so I have certain subjects I want to talk about. When I go on a vacation, I will go out in a boat at a lake and sit down with the altar book and go through and pick the sermon texts and go over them. For example, here I have my sermon themes and texts listed up until August 4th. Before August 4th, I will have been at some place for a vacation. I'll go out in a boat early in the morning at the lake, take the altar book and the Bible, row around, cast, and read this, and meditate, and muse over it, and see what comes to mind. Jot something down in the notebook. If it isn't at a lake, it's maybe in a hotel room, motel, but I want to get away from the church when I do this. I want to get into a setting quite different and muse over it. And what is the dominant thought that comes to mind? Now this Sunday's it's a ready answer. They were all together in one place. That came to me on Pentecost. The importance of being together if the Holy Spirit is coming. And Nicodemus, he came at night, is the next one. I like this theme, out of circulation. The parable of the lost coin. There was nothing the matter with the coin, but it was out of circulation. A book is no good unless it's read. A fine man, a good moral man, is no good unless he's in circulation. A Christian is of no value just sitting in the pew. It's the coin that's in circulation. The coin wasn't a counterfeit, it was a good coin. And Christians, be merciful. Another one, what do you think? Hath thy brother aught against thee, when not thy brother's keeper? And the sermon text I like is, this is a lonely place, and the day is now over. And that's a passage. And the 14th chapter of Matthew, the 15th verse. They're out in the desert, and the multitude is there. And one of the disciples come up to Jesus and said, this is a lonely place, and the day is now over. How many man has arrived at the point in life where he said, this is a lonely place. The hopes are gone, the future is done. Man may be in his 20s, and he's a lot of hope, but he comes at a time when there's no future. Or he goes to the doctor, and the doctor says, I'm sorry, but you've got cancer. The thing is done. And the day is now over. You can develop quite a thought on that. But the important thing in this text is, the disciple was mistaken. This is the thing to bring home. He was mistaken. It wasn't a lonely place for a number of reasons. One is, all the friends were there of this disciple. Second is, Jesus was there. It ought not to have been a lonely place. He saw the multitude. He didn't see what it was close at hand. And third is, the only miracle that's recorded in all four Gospels took place at this point. So when he said the day was over, the greatest event was yet to take place. So in many a person's life, you can reassure them that what seems to be the end of the rope to them, the best is yet to be. This is a lonely place, and the day is now over. Well, this is the way I start out. Then I read the text out loud several times. You know, it's a strange thing when you read it out loud. Different phrases come to mind, a different emphasis. I never saw this phrase, which is in the Revised Translation, until I'd read it out loud. Then suddenly stuck in my mind that this man said, this is a lonely place and the day is now over. And then it struck me again, he was mistaken. It was not a lonely place and the day was not over. And this has a tremendous impact on the people sitting in your pew who feel they're done, it's over with, it's through. There's no hope. They'll never succeed in business. They'll never succeed in marriage. They'll never succeed in their family. They'll never succeed in getting places. And then to tell them, great is yet to be. This getting at a distance is important. Lilienthal, chairman of the Atomic Commission back in the late 40s, used to take the whole commission up in an airplane to study their problems and look down at the earth and say, it's for those people down there that we are working on this Atomic Commission problem. He saw the importance of perspective. And we need to get away from the crabby members, the sweet members, the good members, the poor members, the problems, and get off at a lake or someplace to look at these texts. I think it's a good beginning point. A lot of people think that, you know, that we're aiming at them in the sermon. I have a friend, a minister, who can bear down pretty hard in the sermon. And he was bearing down pretty hard, and a woman without thinking got up and said right during the sermon, "That wasn't me, Pastor, it was my sister." That's getting pretty realistic, isn't it? Now there are special sermons, and I mentioned here for Thanksgiving is one. I like the text where it says they brought palms and willows to glorify the Lord. Palms are the triumph, willows the beating and the lickings and the sorrows and the grief. Both are necessary for the development. The palms, the joys, the babies born, the victories, the joys and triumphs. And the text which is my favorite text in the whole Bible. Often I've had people ask me, "What is your favorite Bible passage?" It is in 2 Timothy, the first chapter, the 6 and 7 verse. "Stir up the gift of God that's in you. For God gave us not a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of discipline." And you watch young people today, do they have these three qualities? God gave us not a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of discipline. Power, love, and discipline, no fear. And you have Reformation Day, all the special things. You know, I've often invited special people in for Reformation Day, but I found my people prefer to hear me. And I suspect when I've been invited to a Reformation Day festival to give it to something different, I think they'd rather have heard it in their own church. I'm not so sure these big Reformation Day festivals, I don't like to take any away from it because I'm sure many of them are good. But I think your own people like to hear you on these great themes. What do you think, Pastor, about the Reformation? What do you think is the contribution of Martin Luther? You can make it different and special in the music. Mother's Day, I capitalize on that by making it, as many of you do, I'm sure, it's Family Day or home. I emphasize the home rather than the mothers. The good mothers feel terribly embarrassed. The bad mothers are praised and they shouldn't be. Avoid, whether it's an Easter or Christmas or any of these days, being overly sentimental. Don't make Christmas a children's day. I didn't like what a man said over the radio. Christmas belongs to children. It doesn't either. It belongs to all of us. I oftentimes preach a series of sermons. People like series of sermons, I've found. But there shouldn't be 7 or 8 sermons in the series. 3 or 4 at the most. And I found that if I announce a month ahead, I'm going to preach a series of sermons on the parables, like I did on the 3 parables of Jesus, the lost sheep, the lost coin, and the lost son. And I've also preached a series of sermons on the creed, series of sermons on the Lord's Prayer. People do like series of sermons, because so oftentimes you can't develop it, the subject you have in mind, in one sermon. Here's an interesting theme for the prodigal son: home, sick of home, homesick. Think that one through. Home, sick of home, homesick. Another one about the prodigal son, I'm sure you've observed those 3 striking phrases Jesus put in it, where the prodigal says, give me my portion. This is the philosophy of the world. What do I get out of it? What's my share? What's my pay? What do I get? Give me. And the son didn't deserve what he got. I mean, in the sense that he hadn't created that wealth. His father had. And a lot of our younger generation today want everything, forgetting it was created by somebody else. The gimme attitude. Here's an interesting thing. You can use an illustration. Henry Ford was one time driving in Michigan when roads are no good. His Ford got stuck in the mud. The farmer came out, didn't know who he was. Went in, hitched up a team, pulled him out of the mud, got him on the main road, and Ford pulled out, tore from $5. He said, nothing doing. He said, keep it. He said, can't a man do a favor for a stranger, said the farmer, without being paid for it? A week later, a new Ford was delivered to this farmer with a little note on it. Can't a man do a favor for a stranger without being paid for it? Isn't that interesting? So the good deeds we do, where we're not saying, gimme, 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 the reward is many, many times over. But the philosophy of the world is giving. All over, isn't it? Get your radio repaired. Man, they sock it to you. I had my washing machine repaired, $35. It was there just a short time. I had the antenna fixed on the roof, $24. I had this, my car, my automobile, the water pump leaked, and before I could get off the highway, it had done quite a bit of damage. Got it to a garage, cost me $670. I can't argue with him. He gives me a long list of things to put in there. I can't take the engine apart and see it. But I think of when I was in Hemet, California. I was having trouble with my car. My brother-in-law who lives there said, I'll take you to a right mechanic. Took it to this mechanic. He looked at it. He said, I really don't know what's wrong, but I think we can find it. That's some confession to begin with. And he went over it, and we talked about it, and he worked on it a good half hour, and he got it going, fixed up, and I said, how much is it? $2. $2, I said. Man, I said, you can't stay in business that way. He said, but the satisfaction of seeing the smile on your face and knowing the problem is solved and that I solved it, he said, it's worth it. I make plenty of money. How many mechanics are like that? Let me tell you another one. When in Minneapolis, I traded my car Pontiac in for a new car at the Dodge company there. I wanted $950. I thought I'd only get $850, so I asked $950. And he said, okay, gave me $950, and I thought no more of it. As you know, it's difficult to get cars then, and secondhand cars are way up in price too right after the war. About a month later, I went for the checkup. The car, and I came in, and he said, I went to see the boss. And, say, by the way, he said, we sold that old clunk of yours. He said, we didn't get what we expected. I got to revise what I paid you. I thought, the man can't do that now. That's too late. He said, we got $200 more than we expected. He said, I'm giving you another $200. How many would you find like that? How many would you find like that? Always after that, I went to this man when I bought a new car in Minneapolis. I just drove in. He said, what you want? I said, you set the price. Whatever you give me, satisfactory to me. What nice relationship that is, isn't it? That you trust the man. We have a man in Chicago, Rodner Benson. He's one of the biggest contractors in the United States. He builds many of those oases you see across the freeways. He's built some biggest buildings in Chicago. And when General Motors had him put up a building, they just said, you draw it up, whatever you want. They didn't stipulate any contract or anything, whatever you set right in the midst. Those are the men of the salt of the earth. And by the way, he's a very good Christian, fine member of the Lutheran Church there in Chicago. He talks with a big Swedish accent, but he's one of the nicest men I know. And you'd be delighted to know Ragnar Benson. One time he took all his relatives, flew them to Sweden, hired a special train in Sweden, and toured all Sweden with all his relatives, 50.
The king has come back.
Yes, sir. Well, that's the philosophy opposite to give me. Then after he'd been in the pig pen for a while, you'll notice that the father didn't go and pull him out of the pig pen. He just let him stay there. A lot of people have to go just through so much banging around before they come to their senses. Some people can get socked on the head and they learn. Say, well, I guess I wasn't quite so smart as I thought I was. Some people can burn their fingers and say, whoop, I'll stay away from that stove. But some people seem to gotta get burnt over and over again and socked again and again until they land in a pig pen before they come to, and you can't do anything about it. Mothers are oftentimes disturbed about their children. I've often said, just leave them alone. They know what's right. And they'll come through, just take its time. As you've seen, many young person has gone all the way around and come back again. A lot of people got to be hit hard with troubles, sorrows, difficulties before they come to their senses. And that's the phrase, when he came, you remember he said when he was in the pig pen, look at there, all the good things my father's servants have. He said, I know what I'm going to do. He makes a resolution, you see. I'm going to my father. And I'm going to say to my father, I'm no longer worthy to be called thy servant. Make me as one of thy servants. But if you read the story, when he gets to see his father, he leaves a little bit of that out. A little of that he leaves out. We oftentimes make great resolutions when we're caught in a tough situation, but we forget them later on.
Just on this, on a parable, Dr. Scott, that heads up the Oregon Rehabilitation Center in Oregon, in Portland, one time had a group of preachers around, and he asked us, he said, from the point of view of a counselor, he said, the parable of the prodigal son, he said, what is the significant thing? And so somebody jumped in and said, well, the love of the father for the child. No. And finally, somebody popped up and said, well, maybe you mean when he came to himself. And he said, that was what I was at.
Yeah.
He says, you can't make a man come to himself. Mm-hmm. But when he does come to himself, you'd better be there.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, when the man comes back.
Yeah. The thing is, all of us make resolutions when in a tough spot.
Yeah.
It's like the two fellas on the raft, been on the raft for a couple of days. And one of them started to offer a prayer. And he said, Lord, if you'll save me, I'll give you. And then the other fellow said, hold it. He said, I think I see a ship.
I think that was just something on the horizon. Didn't throw the ship, because the story goes on. Then you see, they think, well, we've got to do something. And the guy that thought he could pray couldn't pray. Isn't there anybody that can pray? How about singing? Anybody sing a hymn? No. What can we do here then? Well, probably the first one. I know one thing we can do. We can take up an offering.
That would sink the ship. And as that phrase comes, then you remember, it says, make me. And as I told the confirmants, this is the whole purpose of this confirmation instruction, that you'll be made into something all your life. Made into a good mother, made into a good father, made into a good citizen, whatever it is. God makes us into something. It's a process of being made. I like to use the illustration of my father, who was a blacksmith. One time, was a blacksmith. I worked for some time in Stoughton Wagon Works. And I used to go in the tracks above, and my father's shop was down below. And as we went by, we'd wave to each other. He showed me, he took a piece of iron. He said, now here's a piece of iron, he said to me. Shoved it in the fire. He pulled it out right out, and then he shoved it into cold water. And he pulled it out, and then he shoved it back into the hot fire. And then into the cold water. Now he said, if this is a good piece of iron, it has now become a piece of steel. But it has to stand these extremes of cold and heat. And the molecules, he didn't use this language, but I presume the molecules then congealed and could stand the extremes. It has now become a piece of steel. But if it's a poor piece of iron, it crumbles and falls on the apart. And so I think life is the same way. Man goes through one extreme to the other, the hot and the cold. Can he take it? Can he come through, make me? And through the process, he's made into something. This is life, to be made into something. And of course, you preached a sermon on the other son. The other son, that's one that I think should be preached more often, where he needs to Christianize his disposition. We have a lot of people in the church that, man alive, they don't steal, they don't land in pig pens, they don't carouse, they don't get drunk, but boy, they got rotten dispositions. I think of a woman in Los Angeles, belongs to one of the member of one of the Lutheran churches there, and I know all of you know the ministry. He's a splendid fellow and a keen sense of humor. But he's got a woman in the church that sits there and takes notes on his sermon and then writes to the members during the week criticizing the sermon and has subscribed for a radical magazine for every member of the congregation, quite opposite to what the minister teaches, and has prayer meetings across from the church in a building which he rents a room and invites members to come to pray for the minister that he'd be saved.
Oh.
Now it takes a lot of the grace of God, and this fellow has it. He told me that one Sunday when she went out the door and he shook hands with her, he said to her, "Where do you wish to have me send your transfer?" she didn't have it sent anywhere, but she still sits there. Well, we all have those kind of people in our pews. People with rotten dispositions who just sit there to find fault and to criticize. They're in your church and my church. And you lean over backwards to try to win them. I've gone right to the homes of some of them and said, "Now, what is it? What can I do? What's wrong?" But you haven't changed any. I've kidded some people, joked with them, tried to win them some other way, or tried to find the reason for it. I think one man in my church whom I told before I got there was a great troublemaker. I was fortunately told beforehand. So I found out that this man was terribly disappointed in life in certain areas where he thought he was going to succeed. And I made it a point to praise him in front of the congregation on a number of things and speak highly of him. To this day, that man will swear by me. He would lick my boots to this day. He found that somebody felt he was somebody. And there are many different ways of winning these kind of people, but not in the area in which they're set. You've got to find some other area over here where you can praise them and compliment them. But they can be a thorn in the flesh, all right. "Alexander the coppersmith hath done me much harm," said Paul. And so there are coppersmiths in all congregations. This other son, what a spoiled brat he was. Pouted, wouldn't come in the house. Why, he should have run out and greet his brother. "Glad you're home. Come on, what can we do together?" And he complains to his father, "You never gave a dinner for my friends." Well, he probably didn't have any. The father would have been only too glad to give him a dinner for his friends if he'd shown some instances that he had any. So here he's blaming his father for his own lack. What a rotten disposition. And yet I suspect, like this book called The Enemy in the Pew, there are a lot of people dragging their feet in the church. I can go to your church and say some of the things that I'm saying, but I can't say it myself. Here you can't say it in your own church. Well, in your sermon, now when you come to the sermon, avoid being sensational. You've got to be preaching there Sunday after Sunday. I can come to your pulpit and be sensational one Sunday, but you can't live on that kind of diet. I had a minister preach for me one Sunday, and he began with the most striking illustration I ever heard. Tremendous. But he couldn't maintain that level. And the sermon went down, 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 down like that. Everybody was waiting for another peak. He'd hit the highest peak, and there isn't any higher. And I told him afterwards, that should have been near the end of your sermon, not at the beginning. There's a striking illustration. So as you begin, remember your congregation is with you. They're not against you. You've got them all on your side. Don't start out as though you're going to start an argument. Don't start with your fist doubled up as this today. We've got an argument with those people sitting in the pew. I think I can truthfully say I've never aimed a sermon or any part of a sermon at anybody sitting in the pew. But at the same time, I do not shrink from anything in the sermon because it might hit somebody in the pew. And this is a difficult thing to cultivate. It's a hard thing. Because you have people say that you aimed that sermon at me, it was for me. Well, that's a good thing. If it wasn't on your part deliberately aimed. God knows what's in the hearts of those people. He knows what's in your sermon. I like to believe when I'm working on a sermon, God is looking over the shoulder. And he's going around the community and saying, "Well, you've got to be in church on Sunday. That sermon's for you. Here, you've got to get there. This is for you." And I think the Spirit is working on those people out there as well as he's working on me. And there may be somebody saying, "You better stay away from church. This is doing more harm than good, isn't it?" This Sunday.
Have you ever noticed on certain Sundays, like stewardship Sundays, where they know this beforehand, your attendance goes down a little Sunday?
Always does. Yes. Right. Isn't that something? What's the trouble? Well, of course, the trouble is we've filled our church too much with people who are not particularly committed to the Christian religion. They're there because it's a respectable thing. Their mothers and fathers belonged. They ought to be a little bit religious, so that they better belong. And so the circle of committed is small. And some of those rascals are very attractive, too. Sometimes very delightful to be with. Sometimes more so than even your committed members. It's a strange thing. All right, I like the verse, I think it's Luckock who says, I love preliminary things, the tuning up of flutes and strings, the little scrolls musicians play, the varying pleas to feel their way, but most to see the curtain rise, and the curtain rise on the sermon. Everything else, the preliminary in the sense, sermon is tremendously important, and don't belittle it. This is a tremendous opportunity, and you ought to be fit, prepared when you step into the pulpit. Don't have a low concept of the sermon. Tremendous thing, isn't it, that you are as an ambassador of Christ stepping up there, and you're the channel of the Spirit of God. Every eye is fastened on you. It's awful easy then to fasten it on yourself, too, and begin to think you're important. In your sermon, have a short introductory sentence, if you can. It shouldn't be too profound. Remember, you're gathering your people together intellectually. Many of them are on one level than another. So your opening sentence shouldn't be too long, shouldn't be too profound. It should be engaging. For example, a sermon I preached on, weight or wings. Is religion weight or wings? I simply say a man's religion can be weight or it can be wings. It can be a burden or it can lift him above the soil of this earth. That's enough. That gives them a clue as to what's coming. And then you may deviate from that. Your opening paragraph shouldn't be too profound. It should move, but it ought to give them a chance to get into your thinking. You've been thinking about it all week, but they have. You've got to pull them in gracefully. Tension is important right from the start. Sometimes a good pause is important. I go into the pulpit. The choir sings a short verse, which I think tends to settle the people down after sitting or standing or singing, whatever's been done. And then I offer a prayer. My prayers are written. The opening prayer in my sermon is always written. I write it usually on Saturday night. It is a time when I am alone and quiet, and I try to think of my congregation. What is it that I want to present to the throne of God? My congregation knows the prayers written. This is the only thing I've written or the only thing I look at when I'm preaching. And I hear our prayers here like this, typed out like that or written by hand, something like this. Sometimes a prayer will have certain pauses in it, like, Lord, I've been stubborn during the week. Pause. Have I mistreated my children? Pause. Give them a little chance to think it through. I try to make the prayers right down to earth. And in every audience, there is somebody who is in a moment of despair. Someone who's in grief. Somebody who feels like the bottom has dropped out of life. In your prayer, there must always be a sentence for them. He's kept in perfect peace, whose mind has stayed on thee. Some little passage, some little phrase. Then there are young people jumpy, they're too interested. You have to capture them, their imagination. And some people in middle-aged life have felt success. They're in the full strength of their mind and body. And they're apt to think that they're the master of the fate and the captain of the souls. And you have to have something in there for them. Think it through.
Dr. Yorley,
yes?
Do you look at this prayer as... Because I've heard just the opposite from some homiletic professors, where they say, well, this is not the introduction to your sermon, not a place for what we would call, or what I would call that, to be a pastoral prayer. But you feel this really serves a good purpose to have a pastoral prayer.
That's right.
Before you begin your message.
Yeah. It does not pertain to the sermon. Mm-hmm. It is now I am their shepherd. I am now approaching the throne of God for my people. Mm-hmm. And it has had a tremendous effect. I've had more requests for my prayers than for my sermons. And they know it. They know it's written out. And the reverence that comes over the audience is a feeling that this, they know, is not just Lord bless this, Lord bless the other thing, Lord let's do this, where you run all over the waterfront looking for something to say in the prayer. That's another reason why I, in a gathering of ministers, I never like to have somebody say, Pastor Yorkland, will you offer the prayer? I don't feel like coming into the presence of the Lord that carelessly. Whenever I have a group of ministers or meeting, I ask a man beforehand, will you give the prayer? No matter how casual the meeting may be, so that he has a chance to think and prepare himself mentally for it. We sometimes treat prayers and devotions too lightly.
Do you use the general prayer?
Sometimes, you mean at the conclusion? At the end of the, I'll tell you about that in a moment. Yes. I think too oftentimes we treat devotions too lightly in groups. When I was in Minneapolis at our pastoral conferences, we'd have a devotions at the beginning, and pastor would read and give a little talk. The ministers would dribble in. And by the time it was over, then we had a group. Those ministers are saying the devotions isn't important. Praying, reading scriptures. So I said to them, the devotions are going to be in the center, not in the beginning. Maybe these men have a reason for coming late. So from that time on, in the middle of the program, we had the prayer and the scriptures. Because I said, this is the most important part of our meeting. Let's watch out in our meetings. We don't treat this too lightly. Don't ever, because there's a minister present, somebody say, Pastor, will you offer the prayer? You know how it is in service groups. Many times I've walked in, and immediately as I walked in, Pastor, will you give the prayer for the meeting? Well, I am in no mood. I've been joking or kidding with somebody. I got to have a moment of quiet. I got to think. I got to set my mind in tune. Therefore, I do have set prayers that I can say, let my mouth go. And I presume it fulfills the situation, but I do feel still uncomfortable about it. But I do believe it's an important part, that opening prayer. Read it. Where I got the idea, and man, most everything I know I've copied from somebody. When I was a student at the seminary, they had a great preacher in the Presbyterian Church, Bushnell. He was at the end of his ministry. I was still to begin. Bushnell used to pray sometimes 15 minutes. He was then as talking to God about his people. It was a magnificent thing. And sometimes the sermon would be only 5 or 10 minutes long. The prayer would be 10, 15 minutes long. He was a great preacher. And if you go to Westminster Presbyterian Church in Minneapolis, just ask about the older ones if they remember Bushnell, and they'll tell you he was the great spirit. Our students at Luther Seminary used to go down on Sundays regularly to hear him preach. He was the great preacher of the time. Roy Smith was there, another great Methodist preacher of a different type. Did you ever hear Roy Smith anymore?
No, I never did.
He was a remarkable person. I liked him immensely. He was 100% outgoing. He had a big booming voice. He spoke at a dinner at some club, and everybody was to bring something. And one man brought a burlesque girl who went up and down the aisle patting people on the cheek, and she was scantily dressed. They came to Roy Smith, and she patted him, and he took the glass of water and threw it right back at her. Only Roy Smith could do it. Roy Smith, when he was in Minneapolis, used to have Sunday evening service that were so crowded that people couldn't get in. They'd get there an hour early and get tickets outside to come to be the first ones to get in next Sunday to the services. He used to dress during the service and like Moses and so on. A rare personality. He's written some books, and if you have a chance, read them. He's one of these off the beaten track, and a lot of people criticize him, but I don't. I thank the Lord for these odd ducks that come along and change things in life. They make it much more interesting, like a woman's hat. Women's hats, you know, never look alike. My wife was criticizing the hat of a woman once. I said, thank the Lord for that woman's hat. It's totally different. You women, the rest of you, don't have the audacity to wear a hat like she's got. And so it is with difference in types. I was in a hotel in Cleveland, big, fine hotel, sitting there eating my breakfast. In came Roy Smith. I hadn't seen him for 4 or 5 years. But I'm sure the rascal looked up in the book to see if there were any preachers there and got my name. So he comes in, and he had a voice that he hears 6 blocks away. And, why, hey there, Yodlin, how are you? Come slap some breakfast with you. Say, he said, have you heard this joke? And he told me a story. I'm sure you heard it. The 4 Boy Scouts that came to the meeting. And the scout leader said, have you done your good turn today? And they said, no, they hadn't. He said, get out of here and don't come back until you've done your good turn. Pretty soon, all 4 of them back in again. And he said, did you do your good turn? He said, the first one. He said, yes, I helped an old lady cross street. Mm-hmm. He said, the second one, what'd you do? He said, I helped an old lady cross street. Mm-hmm. And the third one, the same way, and the fourth one. Well, said the scoutmaster, didn't take all 4 of you to help old lady cross street? Well, said one of the boys, this old lady didn't want to cross the street. Well, now, if you can picture a big, fine restaurant in Cleveland, and Roy Smith telling us aloud that everybody in the kitchen could hear it, and I'm sitting there, I'm the little audience. Well, that's Roy Smith. He was a great soul and great spirit.
By the way, Shorty, we're still waiting for a book of sermons from you.
Thank you. I've had a couple of publishers after me, and I hope that I could get to it. Thank you. Now, the prayer is important. Your opening sentence is important. And when I begin very quietly and speak distinctly. I know that opening paragraph standing on my head. So if a book drops or a door slams or a baby wails, I've got this thing under emotional control. My emotions are up here. And if you don't have emotions, you shouldn't go in the ministry, because emotions are essential in preaching and everything else. But as you know, you prepared, there you are, and they search the surface. Therefore, you must have that opening paragraph under control so that anything can happen and you've got it there. And I begin quietly but firmly. Watch out so you don't move your body too much, shaking your head when you begin. Here's the Lord's message for today, you see. You've wasted a lot of motion and you using your hands too much. That'll come later on. But very quietly begin, but firmly and distinctly make use of pauses. I will oftentimes just look over the congregation, wait until it's quiet, and then I begin. I've drawn them to me. They're, I don't try to reach out and get them by some loud statement or something striking. That might be all right if there's a fire going on. But normally you don't do that. I had a funeral once where everybody was wailing and crying, and I got up to speak in the funeral home,